The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the fourth and final stream for tonight, which is the first night, as we all know. And I'm now here with Porphyrogenitus. First of all, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Oh, yeah, that's actually very good. At least in the sort of anglicized pronunciation, that's most people, that's about as good as I can do with it. I use this nickname, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. I should say that you were on before, that this is not your first time on Millennial. You were on back in 2016. I guess we could do with a bit of reminiscing briefly. That was the first year when Millennial had the format that it was the second time that something called Millennial had been done, but it was the first time that it had the format that is now very familiar to people. So it was I think there were 16 streams that year, and you were one of them. It was something like that, 16 or 20.
It seemed like a lot then, but it's so huge now, right?
It did seem, it seemed like a big undertaking at the time. But now it's, that wouldn't be much nowadays. That would be like 4 or 5 days.
Right.
And I think it was 3 a night. I can't remember, but it was much more on the fly than nowadays, and there was no software system. It was the following year was when I first created a software system to help me do it, and as I was saying to you, that system has been developed with each year, and different functions have been added to it, because otherwise there'd be so much that I had to do manually. So back then, that was before all of this, so 2016 was an important year in the development of Millennial, but also in the alt-right, the movement, and so on. And that's what we're going to be talking about. But I just wanted to give some background to people who weren't watching me back then, so that they know that you and I are old acquaintances, and that you have appeared on Millennial before. I think it will be findable on the website if you go to it. If you go to 2016, I think you'll be able to find his previous appearance. So, in the meantime, why don't you just briefly introduce yourself so that people know who you are?
Well, online I am Porphyrogenitus, and I've actually had this alias going back to the 90s for unrelated reasons back in the day. I mean, and that's another of the things that became controversial right around 2016 is all these anonymous posters. But in the era of the internet that you and I both came up in, it was the odd thing would be if somebody used their own name, right? You were online, you had an online persona. And so this is what I've had going back to the 90s. And then I was an early blogger. I don't blog now for various reasons, but I was one of the early bloggers, and my views have changed quite a lot since then. I was one of those pro-Iraq war, counter-jihad, my democracy, Team America people back in that era. And, I don't regret a lot of that, but obviously our views have changed quite a lot since then, haven't they? So, and what you just said too, and I don't want to hog the mic too much, but what you just said too about the development of Millennial is sort of a microcosm of the macrocosm of the dissident right, in a way. Those early heady days of 2015 and 2016, we were all so full of enthusiasm over the prospects and what we seemed to be accomplishing so fast, and what seemed to be that we were going to be able to get done in a short time. And we sort of ran right up against the reality of what we're facing, which led a lot of people into, and I was sort of one of them. And so I took a step back too, from being too vocal, into a little bit of a disillusionment. But people like you, and I have kept up with the space and kept commenting, you know, on a small scale. But what you really have done is build an institutional groundwork, because now there's been like a sobering realization of exactly what we face and what will be needed to both organize a dissident right to the degree that you can organize this herd of cats, and make an ongoing effort going forward. And I think you've done quite an impressive job on your end of things, for example, in getting this all together and getting people to exchange views, because clearly there's a spectrum of opinion on the dissident right, of course. So,
yeah, and there always was.
Right.
And otherwise millennial would be very boring.
No, right?
If we were just all agreeing with each other all the time, saying the same opinions over and over. I mean, I try to have a mix of people. But yeah, that's a decision in itself. But
right.
I think, as it was known back then, the alt-right was also very, I think, even more mixed, really.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there was a heavy libertarian element in the alt-right that really isn't there in the dissident right. I mean,
well, there was the alt-right, and there was neo-reaction, and there was the sort of libertarian wing that was half in and half out of the alt-right, because that term was also really contested right from the beginning, in certain respects, right?
Yeah. I can't even remember the history of it now. I tried to hold on to it in my head for a long time, right, because I so frequently heard people saying things that were incorrect.
Yeah.
So I wanted to hold on to the real history, but even I have now forgotten it.
Well, at least there are those old videos. It's just that there's how much time. There's people. There's so much content that's now created in the broad dissident right that it's hard to keep up even with part of it. On a weekly basis, much less go back and rewatch some of these videos that really contained, and a lot of your early thoughtful videos where you were clearly working through things almost as if it was, even when it was just you sitting down, it would be almost as if you were having a conversation with the audience while working out in your mind exactly where you were going to arrive at, that you eventually arrived at, right? You know, I mean, and a lot of that was taking place at the time. So those are some very important, informative years for the whole space, but we really just don't have time to go back and watch it all over again, unfortunately.
No, sometimes I wonder about doing that. I think about, you know, sitting down and doing a live stream where I watch one of my old videos. It just seems so narcissistic. I don't think it'd be a good look.
You know, on the one hand, it might seem narcissistic, but on the other hand, you mentioned now that some of your audience wouldn't have known that I had been on before, because there are many new people in the space, and they might benefit from seeing you reflect on your own reflections in a way. One of the short, like you did some of these short videos that were they still stay with me today. Like, I think of the reading you did of Rudyard Kipling's Recessional, right?
Oh, yes.
And the whole artistic mood of that, with the way the lights went and all that. I mean, some of these things are like, it may feel narcissistic to you to revisit them, but some of your new viewers would probably be very interested in seeing, like, where you can go over some of that and say, oh, this is what I thought then, but here are the nuances now where I still think that, but on this point I'm different. You know what I mean?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, my thinking has evolved a lot. But, I would have to literally, because, you know, I forget about myself as well, my own development. I forget what did I think about that in 2018 or 2014. I can't remember because life is so complicated.
I know, right? Now I don't feel alone since you say that because I have a hard time with my own memory, right?
Yeah. It's been like that for years for me. I can't tell you what I broadly remember some things, but you know, life is just so complicated, and your thinking is changing all the time in little ways. So well, it's very difficult to keep track of this.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I shouldn't step in so much.
No, but you are. Don't worry about that. You're the interviewee, so it's your floor.
There were a lot of events that we thought of as important now that we might think of as, well, why we're, you know, we fixated on this. Like, and of course, the big picture remains what it is. The problems remain what they are. Those haven't really changed. But I'm talking sort of the week-to-week, month-to-month events of this, you know, this happening and that happening, some of which have seemed momentous at the time and others but faded in importance, but others were really pivotal, like you know, and I hate to bring up Charlottesville and things like that, but you know, since you mentioned the alt-right, some of that was really pivotal in that the loss of some of that early enthusiasm, but then the sobering and getting more mature about, okay, we face an enemy that's not just going to be a pushover. And I mean, friend-enemy distinction, right? And this is going to, even though there's an urgency to getting these people out, you know, to clearing them out, as it were, it's going to take a lot more than we have before we're ready to do that even, which is like, on the one hand, that was dispiriting, but on the other hand, it has led people like you and the whole range of other people that we could mention, and I hate to run through a list because I'm going to leave some very important people out, to really do a lot of building that have sort of, back then, so much could be blown away by some event and the authorities just going after the people involved, whereas now our foundation, I think, is much, much stronger in many ways due to the things that you're doing or due to basket weaving or some of the events in Britain, the various conferences. And I know you were going to conferences years ago too, but these two sort of like millennial have matured and become more institutionalized in keeping a network very engaged with itself and as well as with the, you know, what we face in the wider world, right?
Yeah, for sure. Sorry, I was just checking whether it's on Odyssey, and for some reason this stream isn't going on to Odyssey. I don't know why.
Shocking.
Oh, that's a technical annoyance. Sorry about that, everyone. I think it's on Twitter, though, and I think it's on, well, I know it's on Telegram, so that's fine. So, yeah, I think that back then, it's kind of alarming to look back and think we really did believe that we could change the world. But the really amazing thing is that we thought we could change the world just by spreading ideas, and that we would just win in the battle of ideas.
You know, well, in some ways, by electing people like Trump, he was going to listen to us, and we were going to, you know what I mean? Or in Britain, you know, various figures, you know, I mean, and
yeah,
that really didn't happen, right?
Yeah, I think that we had this naive idea after hearing how great democracy is for so long. We had this idea that, well, okay, I might have a few complaints about democracy, but I believe, maybe instinctually, maybe subconsciously, I do believe in democracy. So therefore, if I put my ideas out there, they will be heard and they will be democratically, you know, treated. And the free marketplace of ideas will rule and win the day and govern the result. What we didn't realize, at least some of us, including myself, what we didn't realize was that it really doesn't work like that. And democracy is a sham.
Right.
The public are complete NPCs, and the powerful aren't going to just let you take over because you've got better ideas than them. Well, they're going to crush you with every tool at their disposal.
And here I'm going to pat myself on the back in a way, but then take it back with the other hand, because already by, you know, like I said, when I was an early blogger, I was my democracy, yai, rah, rah, rah. But already after 2008 and 2012, particularly, I didn't even vote in those elections because I had become disillusioned with it. But, you know, so I in my head, I doubted democracy. But with Trump, I was like, maybe this is the one more time. Lucy with the football. If you've ever seen that old Snoopy bit, right?
Charlie
Brown Peanuts bit, right? Maybe this will work. Maybe, just give it one more college try. And it was totally going to let us, like you said, they're totally going to let us have somebody sympathetic take
the levers of power. Right? And it was the same with Brexit. You know, a democratic result got what we wanted. But I think it's important to say that you can believe in something in different ways, at different levels.
Oh, yes.
We were very, very cynical about democracy. It was just sort of luck that, you know, Trump won and Brexit won. We happened to get what we wanted. But I think we were very cynical about it. And I'm pretty sure I made videos decrying democracy.
Oh, yeah.
And yet at some level, we clearly had internalized. This is my point. I think despite the cynicism, we had internalized the idea of democracy. Right. So that's why we thought we can change the world. Just by talking and spreading ideas. And so it was a bit of a shock to realize that it really doesn't work like that. And as I say, the powerful will protect their interests, which means they will shut you down. They will shut down your YouTube channel and your means of making a living, and they will deprive you of freedom of speech. They will certainly write hit pieces on you. They'll even visit you at your home.
People have been jailed, serious prison,
for sure. People have been imprisoned for all sorts of things in Britain.
Americans, and I, I'm going to speak up for my country while also decrying in a bit. We, even though, back in their era, we would scoff at the idea of the marketplace of ideas, but sort of like what you're saying is at some level we still believed it. And in America, we believe that, okay, unlike you guys, unlike you, you Europoors, we have the First Amendment. So sure, we can go to Charlottesville and protest and have our views heard just like the left does, right? And exactly. They're not going to do anything to us. They're going to treat us the same. They're going to treat us fairly. And in some ways, the legal system arguably did for some people, but it clearly didn't for others. And
look, Antifa professor hit someone over the head with a bike lock.
Right.
He had gone there with the bike lock in order to hit someone over the head with it. And then he did so. And he got off with it.
Right.
I think it was a $1 fine or something. Meantime, James Alex Fields is in prison for 400 years.
Right.
For causing a fat woman to have a heart attack.
One of my last stools to fall out of my old belief was the idea of the rule of law meaning something, right? That line from the movie Excalibur, where King Arthur says the law applies to high and low to me, or it means nothing at all. And I did think that though our elites were corrupt and lawbreaking, that on some level they wanted to at least keep the appearance of that. But the mask is one thing that has happened is the mask has totally slipped away, but they seem to be able to brazen their way through it, right?
Yeah,
so and they don't even pretend.
Another aspect of how powerful the powerful are, that they don't need to even pretend to abide by their own moral precepts. They're perfectly happy to brazenly, openly be corrupt and be inconsistent and be hypocritical. They don't care. Oh, yeah. And I think back in 2016, they wouldn't have believed that it could be this bad.
Yeah.
The stuff that's happened since then, time and again, I've been amazed. I've been really genuinely amazed at it.
It's how fast it's gone. Like, I was never an accelerationist. You remember back there were these factions in the dissident right who thought, what we really need to do is do the Leninist thing, the worse the better, and try and make the system. And I was never one of those, but it seems like our elites are, right? They're the accelerationists. They're like driving this truck off a cliff, like Thelma and Louise, right? It's like, survivors, right?
And also, they'll call us the extremists just wanting sanity. This is something that never, when we talk about the age of inversion and how everything is back to front, and it's amazing that you know, I'm considered an extremist. Our ideas are considered extreme when all we want is what our grandparents and great grandparents had and could take for granted.
Right.
And what they would have regarded as completely sensible ideas. But right. We're the extremists. I mean, and it's not extreme to want to demographically transform a country. That's moderate. That's the centrist. Sorry, you go. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No. I was interrupting you. I'm sorry. I don't. But I get so enthusiastic about it, especially when we're on the same sort of wavelength, because that's another of the things where we have come to deeply know that things in our parents' and grandparents' age that seemed fine, that we want to return to, that the rot was there too. But what we want is the things that they took for granted, despite the fact that, yes, the elites were already sowing the seeds, as it were, right? The trends were always already being made. What academic agent calls the boomer truth regime, that even he realizes that term is sort of inappropriate because it wasn't created by the boomers. It was imposed on them by the older generations, and in fact even goes back from before, in some ways, before World War II to World War I, and things for that sure. were thrown there, right?
And this really goes for the whole boomer worldview.
Right.
It wasn't them who came up with it.
No.
They didn't write the book, as it were. The book was given to them by older generations. But I think it's a mistake to blame generations.
No.
Because it wasn't the whole of the silent generation or the greatest generation who gave them that set of ideas. It was certain factions within those generations. And this is the generational thing kind of falls away. It's just irrelevant when you're talking about who actually generates ideas.
Well,
but the generational thing is relevant when you're talking about how an idea travels through time and how it's embraced or rejected by, you know, the people who are a certain age at a certain time.
Right. And they could take for granted certain things, even though the underpinnings were being removed, because now it's so clear that the civilizational rot is deep that the thing is just like accelerating off that cliff I mentioned before. But there, most things were still normal for most people. And I think what you mentioned is important, but this gets to our consensus around elite theory. Obviously, it wasn't most boomers who even went to Woodstock or went to the protests. Those were the street soldiers, right? And they didn't come up with the things that put them in the streets in that era. Heck, they were literally Beaver Cleaver's age. And he was like, you know, this kid on the show Leave It to Beaver, who would have been like 8, 9, 10 in the early 60s, right? So
yeah.
Clearly he's not, the people that age are not creating any movements. But Tom Hayden is real, for example, right? And it's the elites at each stage in each phase that set the tone and move the needle in the direction that they want. And what I think one of the things that we're partially still grappling with is there was at some point where earlier, like maybe in the first half of the 20th century, the elite saw our people as sort of endearing, right? Likeable rubes, maybe. So they felt like they needed to be in charge of us, but their narrative was that Norman Rockwell, in America, the Norman Rockwell paintings of the homespun wisdom and the good folk who lived on the block. But sometime in the post-war era, or even during the war, they realized that the mass of people, we wanted programs, we wanted benefits, but we wanted to keep our societies pretty much how they are. But the early progressives, that wasn't their vision, right? Their vision was actually more transformational. It wasn't quite the Marxist vision, but it was much more transformational. But the people weren't going for that. And George Orwell wrote about that in The Road to Whig and Peer, right? About, you know, the sort of labor socialists of that era, and how when they realized that the majority of people, even if they voted for the correct party, right, they weren't going to go for this radical transformation. So they started looking around for, well, what's the explanation for that? And that's where our other good friends come in, with offering up. This is why these are people with an authoritarian personality, and what you really need is a different group of clients, you know. And look, there's places where you can get these client groups if you don't have enough. And so that happened in Europe, even though it didn't have that sort of minority underclass. I mean, obviously it had its underclass, but it didn't have the demographics that we're now all experiencing, right? But they saw, though, these are going to be the vote banks of the future, and the former population is going to be the tax farm until they get dealt with, you know?
Yeah, and I even wonder about the future of democracy. I mean, are they going to? You say that the, you know, the Somalians, the Pakistanis, are the vote banks for a corrupt democracy. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine that the elites have a future in mind in which democracy just doesn't really happen. And so these migrants are not here to vote for the right party. They're just here to, well, so that we can't vote for the right party,
right.
The right party into power.
I get what you mean, but you know, in many of those countries, they have elections. They're just not free and fair. Well, what do we have? We have elections that are just not free and fair, right?
In Iran,
the Guardian Council determines who can run, and then the elections are carried out under that, right? And in Germany, they outlaw parties, right? So I know that things have changed. So when I mention some of this, and it goes back to earlier times, there was more substance to it, even though it was a charade. It seemed more real because it did seem like they would listen more, right? That they would know, well, there's only so far we want to push things because we want an easy life. We don't want, you know, we don't want troubles. Whereas now they're just willing to crack down, right? They're just nakedly cracking down.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think and I was talking about this with the previous guest, that they're now very brazen about not wanting certain ideas. And then they say that they have a moral responsibility, that everyone has a moral responsibility to stymie, to thwart the flow of certain ideas. So there is no free market or open market of ideas. That would be irresponsible. You know, we've all got to curtail that free market of ideas. That's a moral duty, as they see it nowadays. And that's clearly the polar opposite of what the same people were saying 20 years ago.
Right. Well, that's where I think before they could be more relaxed about it, because you might read whatever books you want and whatever magazines you want and whatever newsletters, you know, were mimeographed and sent out by the small faction. But since the avenues for promulgating it were so limited, it was never going to go so far as to challenge them. And I think that's why they, too, faced a sort of rude awakening starting around that 2016 era, though they had started to crack down on the internet in various places earlier than that. I think they too, had their initial enthusiasm that, look, if we unleash something like an internet, a free space of ideas, ours will win out. You know, they're very confident. We clearly see that they hold not just wrong ideas, not just misguided ideas, but very destructive, you know, orientations. But they don't think that way. So they thought that it would be an easy win for, you know, that they'd own the right. They do what the dirtbag left does in these pseudo debates that they like to hold, right? And so if they unleashed all of us, they would just be able to easily crush people, you know, whatever perspective we come from.
Yeah.
But then they realized that it wasn't going to be that simple for them either. And so they're using the hard method of cracking down now. They're no longer the easygoing, sure, publish whatever you want, read whatever you want, you know, believe almost whatever you want. We know that only a few people are ever really going to get outside the envelope. And it's never really going to threaten our status, but that is possibly why they felt so threatened by Brexit and Trump, even though they were able to make both those things meaningless.
It was the symbolic rejection of their worldview.
Right, right. That there could be a challenge if they let things go, you know, and yeah.
One other thing is, it's important to say that this homogenization of the marketplace of ideas, it occurs online and social media, the censorship and so on, but it's elsewhere as well. I mean, academia, and you wanted to talk about academia, so we can get this nice transition, I guess. I always remember a visit to a famous London bookshop that I took in 2017, and we went to the philosophy section, and within like that area, and it was a big bookshop, so it had an extensive range in every genre. And the philosophy section was divided into shelving units, and there was one for Marxism. There was one for feminism. There was one for multiculturalism. I can't remember what else. Critical theory. Like, each one of these was, I don't know, 5-6 shelves. Every shelf was full of books, stacked full from one end to the other, of books that are not about critical theory, but are critical theory. That aren't about feminism, but are feminism. You know, it's basically the doctrine delivered over and over again, 1,000 permutations, never questioned, never evaluated, never interrogated, just taken as read, taken on trust, and repeated over and over and over again, so that any fucking dumpling with an IQ of 105 can understand it and absorb it and then spout it. And my point is that in this philosophy section, there wasn't a section that would represent the likes of you and me.
No, no.
Or anything like it. I don't even know if they had a single goddamn Evola volume in the entire bookshop, to be honest. Or René Guénon. Or anyone that we would regard. Or even Roger Scruton.
Right.
You know,
it used to be that they would carry at least stuff by Roger Scruton, or, you know, the sort of the big names on the right would at least get a section, right? But they...
You'd think. I mean, that would surely be warranted. But no, and this is the point I'm making, that is what the philosophy student who's at university just now, he goes into, and this is 5-6 years ago now.
Right.
He goes into this bookshop to, you know, stock up at the start of his degree course. He's going to get material that he feed his mind on philosophy and politics and psychology or whatever. And what does he find? He finds 100 different versions of Marxism.
No, it's the synoptic expression that seems broad only from the inside, but it's like it demonstrates or it defines more by what it excludes than by what it includes. Because like you said, like all these people that you just talked about, they have little disagreements among themselves, just as DR has disagreements among itself. But really, they're all singing from the same hymnal, you know, in effect.
Yeah, on certain things. Just as within the dissident right, we all have certain, I mean... I think most of us, if not all of us, would agree that equality is bullshit, for example. I'm quoting myself there inadvertently, because that was what I said back in the day. Actually, in 2016, when I did the video, Welcome to the Alt-Right, and I said equality is bullshit, I think all of us would agree on that, because it's just nonsense. It's obviously not... equality is obviously not a laudable goal. It's not possible. It's not present anywhere in nature. It's completely against the principles of nature. It's against the principles of human nature. It doesn't work. It's never going to work. If you did implement it, it would be a nightmare. So I think most of us, if not all of us on the dissident right, would agree with that.
Right.
So to that extent, we do agree. But obviously, on all sorts of other things, we disagree. My point is, as you say, those on the left, leftist academia, yes, they have disagreements about this and that, but they are united about the things that matter, and that enables them to be a cohesive whole.
And they, you know, to counterpose that, they are broadly egalitarian, even the ones who will say that equality is bad because what they want is equity. You have to treat people differently in order to achieve the equal outcomes, right? The egalitarian vision. From whatever point of view, be it, you know, feminist or Marxist or, you know, critical theory of, even though they will deconstruct the idea of equality and even egalitarianism while still basically embracing that as a goal. And that's why they all can march to the same direction, broadly speaking, even while fighting like cats. But what you just said there too gets to a difficulty that I think we do face, because even though we broadly agree on some sort of shared vision, with the details matter more within our perspective, maybe precisely because we're not egalitarian. So it's we can all get together for Millennial and coordinate for certain events, but it's going to be very hard for, and this is sort of the struggle that dissident factions face perennial. It's that the thing that was parodied in Life of Brian, like the Judean People's Front split. Popular Front of Judea, right? Because we share a broad goal, but and especially with the idea of clearing out the current elites and achieving a more healthy basis for society. But on the other hand, I don't think that, say, to take two figures that I respect, both these people, but their views of what the vision of what they want to move towards are very different. Take a Greg Johnson or the Distributist. Would one want to say, yes, I'm going to follow where that person wants to go because their goals are close enough to mine, right? Probably not really. And I think this is also why one of the reasons why we still undergo within our own movement, you know, these sort of episodes of, oh, so-and-so's an interest, and we need to purge or excommunicate this or that person. And some of them are done for reasons that have nothing to do with these sort of disagreements. So you ask some of the people who I think maybe aren't going to appear on the Millennial because this or that other person is appearing on Millennial, and they'll say, no, my problem isn't that I disagree with that person. It's that I think this or that, you know, these two people are bad actors, so I won't, you know. And that's true in any movement too, but I think this is a problem that we face in not having a shared positive vision beyond a very broad one. You know,
I would say it's, I mean, I do agree that that's a problem, but I think a greater problem is that people aren't paid.
Okay.
There's no salary structure, and therefore there's no command structure by which people can be told to just shut the fuck up and behave yourselves.
It's true.
Stop falling out. Stop attacking each other. Stop bitching about him. Stop spreading rumors about him. So things escalate. Things get out of hand. And then eventually you've got a rivalry, acrimony, where there needn't have been any.
That's true.
And this is why I always tell people, don't even start shit, because you don't know how far it's going to go.
No.
Just don't. Attack the enemy, not your own people, for fuck's sake.
That's a very good point, because one of the things that, you know, and having been in academia, I started my undergraduate journey back when there was still, like, you know, you would get a nice pat on the head for, like, if you liked, say, Hayek, right? Or if you said you liked Nozick, or you said you like Alistair McIntyre and not, you know, one of the you know, not Rawls, right? You could still get a pat on the head for that, but that has constricted down, like you just said. But I think one of the things that both the academic left and the broader left do benefit from is this network of horrendous NGOs that are all funded by the great foundations that were created by wealthy people, right? Be it the early ones from the early 20th century or the new ones, that Tony Blair gets from Bill and Melinda Gates, right? These funding streams can, because everybody gets to double and triple dip, right? And complain that their salary as an educator isn't so good, but meanwhile they're getting all these grant monies for doing these foundation works, right? And that papers over a lot of difficulties, because if people don't get along in one of these little umbrella groups, they can always just sort of be shunted to another and still get paid to do the same, you know, malevolence, right?
Yes.
Because there's a lot of there's an old saying, because my family has been sort of in and around academia since I was a little boy, I'll just say. And there's an old saying, why are the fights in academia so fierce? And the punchline is, because the stakes are so small. But that does get at the thing, is there are innumerable petty, even the same kind of shenanigans you just described go on in the broad left and go on within the establishment too. It's not like the Clintons and the Obamas got along swimmingly, right? But they could all swim in the same direction because there was that funding. I think it is important, the funding you mentioned, you know, because they're just all swimming in cash, right? So whatever.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that brings professionalism because it brings people who are professionals who aren't even that political necessarily, but they are professionals. So they can get a job done.
Right.
When there isn't money, you've only got ideologue or people who are committed for various reasons. And they're not necessarily professionals.
And well, they have to have a day job. I mean, they have to have a day job, right?
Yeah. And they don't know how to handle disagreements and they don't know how to organize an event or whatever. So this is a big problem. It's something I could write. Again, I could write a book about it. I've got lots of thoughts on it and observations from over the years.
So
really since you were last on Millennial, I've really seen a lot in this direction. So, it's a problem. But my thinking is that what will happen is eventually our ideas will be embraced by people who are more normal, more normies, more just everyday people who will then it'll be a kind of mirror of what's happened, where you've got a whole apparatus, a whole industry. And I'm not saying this as a white pill. I'm just saying it as this is the way that I could see it happening. I'm saying it as a matter of realism, not, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. Because I don't know what form our ideas would take by the time they were acceptable to normies. I'm not sure. But my point is, in the end, it will be well-balanced, well-adjusted, ordinary people who spread these ideas. It won't be fringe figures, I don't think.
And I think you're right that it's not necessarily a white pill because, number one, I think a lot of people do in their heart of hearts think like we do without necessarily having the intellectual underpinnings for it, but they still have that idea of what you mentioned earlier in our discussion of, well, why can't we just have the same society like our parents and grandparents have, right? And a lot of them know what that looks like, or maybe not, unfortunately, the Zoomers, because they were born a little too late to really grow up and see how that functioned. But I think one of the reasons it's not a white pill is because even while a lot of people may think like that, they're not yet motivated to do anything about it. And that means probably things, as bad as things are now, it's almost like we're going to have to go through an even darker period before people will say, I can't. I mean, the Howard Beale thing, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Only instead of yelling out their window, they actually find a way to mobilize. And it's not going to be like the left does or that kind of revolution. So I'm not necessarily advocating anything like that, but it's going to have to be that hard work, right? Normal people doing this sort of hard work, right?
Yeah. The other thing is that I think it would take some faction at the elite level.
Oh, yeah, of course.
To embrace these ideas before you could even have such an apparatus in place and funded to do what we're talking about.
Well, there's two ways that can happen. And one is a faction in the current elite becoming disillusioned with it and basically joining the side of the sort of people who the normal people that you mentioned. Or number two, a mobilization of a counter elite from, and I don't want to say below because it's going to have to be an elite, right? Because, but an organizing a counter elite based on people who would otherwise be in the elite circles, but who have been excluded from it because of some of the things we're experiencing right now. Like one of the transformations in academia that has been accelerated is, and it's also happening in business, at least among the bigger businesses, is they're very firm on who they'll hire and who they won't and for demographic reasons now, to the point where it's reached beyond what it used to be the normal, Well, we're, hiring 50% women and we're hiring 20% of this ethnicity and whatnot. White Gentile males go to the back of the line, but still get hired if they're talented enough. No, they're crowding that down to less than 10% in many fields based on the last statistics I've seen on it. So there are going to be people who know that they have the ability and should be in positions that are out of that, that will find a way, one hopes, to organize a counter elite, even if one doesn't split off from the current governing elite.
That's incredible. But I guess it makes sense. I mean, inevitably, it was going to keep increasing, the thing yeah. about diversity in the workplace. And inevitably, eventually, you would get the situation where the people doing the hiring are themselves ethnic minorities. So they're even more emboldened and committed to promoting people in their own image, literally. Well,
yeah, think of your own Tory party, you know, representing the, you know, the traditional yeah. Britain, right? There you've got, you know, and the prime
minister. What's he doing? He's bringing in more Indians.
Right,
Britain.
And the prime minister is, yeah, he's from an ethnicity that's known for nepotism, right? And I'm not saying that you know, WASPs didn't do nepotism, but there are ethnicities that are pros at it, right? And that's one reason Canadian politics, too, and we're going to touch a little bit on Canada. Canadian politics in some provinces is, controlled by factions of certain ethnicities because those people, you know, and this isn't meant to be, oh, those people and pointing at them. They cohere, right? They support each other. They move people into positions, right? Both in politics and in business. And but then that means that somebody else is getting edged out, right? So there have
and
been
I
difficulties.
Think a component that, here is that white yeah. people, I mean, yeah, white WASPs undoubtedly nepotism and all that, but clearly they're not an ethnic collectivism.
Right, no.
Because otherwise this simply would never have been able to happen.
No.
They clearly didn't have enough of it, which is why it's funny that they're now accused of this exact crime, of being, you know, keeping colored people out of positions and all this, when demonstrably, if we had been like that, then we wouldn't be in this situation now. I mean, it's like the thing about white privilege.
Right.
If we had white privilege, then you wouldn't be able to make a living from moaning at us for being white.
This is where something that I heard several years ago really strikes true is if somebody wants to be really, really malevolent to you, they attack you not for your vices, but for your virtues. They accuse you of the things that will make you feel chagrined, right? And then they can always point to this or that example, right? You know, the country club that wouldn't let so-and-so in. Well, big flipping deal, right? They started their own, right? So that is mostly what's been done, whereas, you know, you're exactly right. If we really had white privilege, the shoe would be on the other foot, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm sure that there was racism, you know, here and there. But my point is that white people are individualistic. And again, that goes back to the problem you mentioned earlier about the movement, how we're so given to falling out with each other. Because we do still, even in this desperate time, we still think we've got the luxury of fighting with each other and infighting when we just don't. I don't know how obvious it could possibly be, and yet people don't get it. So I think that this is obviously something about the white race. It's obviously something about white people, especially white men. But mind you, white women can be very bitchy to each other as well.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, white men. And again, it's like it's sick because this is actually part of what makes us. It's one of our qualities that we are so individualistic. You know, it's one of our qualities that we do strike out on our own and build our own thing and all that, but and have our own minds.
To get back to what you know and relate to this, that we were individualistic, but we also have this sense of fair play that was the great strength when rising up.
Yes,
but when we get accused of not being like engaging in unfair play to the others, we're like, well, maybe we want to listen to that, right? We think, well, maybe there's something to that, and
absolutely.
I think that's one reason they've been able to
absolutely. And you can have conversation. Like I have had conversations with boomers recently, who still think this. Like they'll see an Indian prime minister, and all the rest of it, but they'll get entranced because someone says to them that, well, he had to struggle or whatever, or there's still racism, and the boomer will hear that and think, oh well, so there's a lack of individual merit somewhere. And it's like, man, if there was far more of it, we wouldn't be in this situation. It's precisely that you do get entranced by this accusation that weakens you so much.
Well, and that's one, you know, and since you mentioned boomers, I think it's one reason that they were susceptible, because they came up in the era where it really was 90%, especially even in America, right?
Well, in Britain, it was more than that,
right?
Yeah, in Britain, it was more like 95%, 99%.
Right. And so the idea was, well, you know, okay, you know, what's it going to hurt, right? And they took a lot of, they still take a lot of things for granted because it's still in their peer group, right? If you go to a retirement community like my mother lives in, and she doesn't live, you know, in a assisted living or anything like that, but it's one of these Sun City type places where it's people 55 plus, right? If you're living in places like that, or you're still with your peers, it still seems in some ways like the country is like that. It's just that, like, oh, there's a lot more. Isn't it nice that these brown people are doing so much better in these other, you know, situations, right? But they still have that within their own peer, a sense that what's the issue? We can make way, right? We can make accommodation.
Yeah, they think that nothing's really fundamentally changed. Right. It's still the same old place, still the same old country and society. It's just that there are a few brown people that I see on TV. And the point I was going to make earlier was that they've got this idea of fair play, which I think is very much a white thing. We don't like the idea of corruption or someone being unfairly treated or thwarted, especially not for something that he cannot help, you know, an immutable characteristic. We just see that as completely unjust. He can't help it, so why are you holding it against him, kind of thing? And I, of course, understand that. I mean, right. I feel it myself. It's horrible when someone, for example, is mocked for a disability.
We'd love to live in a society where that fair play still won out, but then the problem is when it carries over, when these other groups have their elbows out and will give what they know is the answer that will cause the white person to back or to check their privilege. They'll say, well, you know, if that person is so angry about that, maybe there's something to it that we could do, or we still needed to do, or we, like, you know, because they grew up watching Roots or whatever, right? They grew up watching Amazon, you know.
I mean, oh, God.
No, right?
The phrase check your privilege, I mean, it could be custom designed for white people, you know, because it really dials into that. You're more lucky than other people, so maybe you should examine that. And make sure that your luck, your unearned, undeserved luck, is not clouding your thinking.
Well, if you read, and I'm not even talking about books written by one specific ethno-religious group, but if you read those critical theory books from whoever came out with one of them, you can dissect them in ways where you know that these phrases were consciously designed to have certain rhetorical effect, because that was the goal, right? And the sort of maskarovka, to mispronounce a Russian word, to get the quote hegemonic society to accede to the
unreasonable demands, including its own castration.
Right, right. Eventually, you know, that's what it became eventually, right? These phrases were crafted precisely to do just that. Academic Agent had a video a few months back on how straight America was bamboozled, wasn't the word, but that was sort of the thing. It's like, and it looked, you know, in that video, he looked at an article that was written in like the late 80s of that. Look, this is here are some things that we can do to normalize, sexual deviancy, and I'm not saying that people who are, you know, gay or whatever are bad. But that was the sort of phrasing that, you know, is current, to normalize that and make them seem bad, right, and put them on the back foot. So it's like it wasn't necessarily even crafted for one use, but it became these tools became multi-purpose tools, right? That now lead to, you know, well, you should let your 8-year-old want to chop his dick off, you know, or remove her tits and get a dick attached, because otherwise you're a bad person, right? You know,
well, exactly. And this is how different factions of the left end up uniting, because they realize that there's strength in numbers and a high tide raises all ships. So you can utilize success in one area to, you know, energize another area.
That's why you get the strange things of, you know, supporters of Sadiq Khan voting for left-wing politicians that batten up their numbers. And I know we don't believe in democracy, but I'm just saying, even if they vote in their own countries, they vote for the concert, you know, they vote for the, you know, radical. You know what I mean? They vote for the extreme mullah faction to win, right? You know,
absolutely. I remember
people who vote, people with Turkish citizenship and Danish citizenship, who vote in both elections, and they're voting for the extreme left in Denmark, because that's the side that they're allied to, and then they're voting for, you know, the. They're voting for the liberal Turkish parties, let's put it that way.
I think in 2017 I did a video making this point, because I talked about in the Netherlands the way that Turkish immigrants voted there compared with how they voted in a referendum. The Turkish, there was a referendum that happened at the time.
Right.
And I think it was about Erdogan's presidency. And then also in Austria and Germany, how Turkish immigrants vote there. And in each of those countries, and compared to how they vote in Turkey. And yes, it again and again, Turkish migrants vote for the far left, like the hard left, but back home they vote for the hard right. It's just remarkable. I mean, it's so in your face when you see it's an interesting phenomenon. But there's not much, I mean, there's no mystery to it. You know, it's very simply explained. They know what they're doing.
Really, you know, I mean, like the, you know, they're allied against the more traditional ethnicities of our countries, to put it that way. You know, I mean,
yeah, they know it's advantageous for their ethnic group if this party gets in, and that's all they care about.
Yeah,
they don't actually care about the politics.
No,
and they certainly, in fact, they disagree ardently with the politics. Right. They don't want trans children, whatever, at school. They're not up for that, but they will vote for it in order to advance their group in that society.
Right.
And this is a whole thing that white people, I think, struggle to understand, because we're so obsessed with, and again, this is especially true of the boomers, they struggle to understand this, but I think all white people struggle to understand it, because we're entranced by morals and principles.
Right.
So the idea of voting for something just on the purely pragmatic basis that it's beneficial to you sort of disgusts us. We think that's very low behavior. No, you should vote for the right, for the thing that is right and good, not that it's good for you personally. That's disgusting. But unfortunately, this high and lofty attitude has very much worked against us.
It's not, because it's not shared worldwide. Just sort of probably concluding your point prematurely is it's certainly not shared worldwide. Indeed, other countries wonder. One of the things, Trump, for all his flaws, was known for uttering some great phrases. And one of the things on the macro that he mentioned is, you know, he talks to Chinese leaders, and you know, he understands why China is doing to us what they do to us. They're just surprised that we're letting them get away with it, you know, because the Chinese are motivated by what's good for the Chinese, right? And we're motivated by, well, look, this is like, this is free trade. We're for free trade on principle, right? You know, even though nobody in our current elites actually believe that on libertarian grounds, right? They're using that as a tool for other reasons, such as the migration. But I don't want to get too deep into that, but that just sort of illustrates your point, is that worldwide, and I'm not saying that other groups have no principles and don't cleave to them, but it is more normal to do things that we would think of and do think of as corrupt transactional politics, right? You know,
Yeah. Well, hold on a minute. I was distracted there momentarily by checking something. But yeah, I think that overall, white people just need to get far more realistic about this. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is a process that's happening naturally as our countries become more, well, less white and more other things, whether it's black, brown or yellow or whatever.
Right.
I think it just seems, especially among the young generations, especially the Zoomers, I think it's just becoming self-evident that groups really do exist, whether you like it or not. They just do. And I hope that they take from that the lesson that if you don't care about your group, then it is just going to get eaten by the other groups. I mean, I think what the reason white people don't like this is that it's so base and primitive.
It seems ignoble. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just it's a horrible reality.
Yeah. Well, and we'll only be able to get back to the sort of vision that I think, like, I agree with you, that is more natural to us, maybe not innate in a genetic, although we can get into the degrees to which it's innate in genetically and also innate culturally. I think there's an overlap. I think in the past, at least, you leaned more towards a genetic explanation. And I'm not totally against that. I think it's like a Venn overlap of tendencies that then have built up to be civilizational norms. But we're going to have to realize that we can only have that within our own system where we have to be the dominant. We have to be the vast majority, if not, complete homogeneity will probably never be achieved. But we have to be the ones that are steering the ship, and we can't let something like this happen again, right? So, in other words, we can't put the toothpaste back to the tube and just go back to, say, 1900. We have to rebuild what we had then with the realization that we're going to need certain safeguards to make sure we don't fall into this pitfall again with the, acknowledgement that civilizations go through cycles, and that's not going to last forever either. But we're going to have to learn this hard lesson that
if we don't fight for our existence, no one else is
going to. No one else is going to take our side. And we've been bamboozled into thinking that the best thing you should do as a white person is to take somebody's side. And then that constantly gets used against us. Again, from both ends of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, both sides in their own way have been trying to harness us to their cause to take just that as a recent example. There are numerous other ones I could pick, by saying, look, we're on the same team, when really they're not on our team. Or what was it? Even Bill Maher came up, this is a struggle for civilization, and with the idea that we should take the side of his ethno-religious group. Well, this is a person who, yes, sometimes he says something that has the people on Fox News saying, oh, even Bill Maher says this part of the left has gone too far, too extreme. But he's never going to be on our side. He just wants to enlist us into his cause.
Yeah.
But that's also true of the Palestinians, right? It's they want to enlist us into their cause, but we need to take our side.
That's the key thing.
High picture.
That's the key thing. We need to take our own side in this.
Yeah.
Some people think that we need to take the Palestinian side. I understand the idea of uniting against a common opponent. I understand that. I just don't think it will actually work, because any union that we could have with the Palestinians, I mean, do we want them moving to Europe by the million? Mm-hmm. That's dreadful. That would be awful.
Their cause isn't our cause, and they're not even trying to ally with us on that basis. Let's imagine that they did move to Europe. Morgoth is right. What would they do? They would do the same thing we just said that Turkish emigres do, right? They wouldn't be on our side. They would support what's supported, even though they don't, like you just said, they don't want they don't want their children being turned into trans kids either.
No.
This is where Morgoth is really on point with this idea. I think that, not to have any rooting interest in somebody else's ethno-religious conflict in the Middle East, because neither of those groups have our interests in mind. And they're not even trying to be allies. You know, neither of those groups are trying to be allies with us.
No, I mean, I don't think they would assist us in any way. Right. And if they were in our societies en masse, I mean, first of all, there's prior experience of this with the Palestinians, right. And they don't integrate, and they do have a very high crime rate. And it's just the typical stuff that one associates with people from the Middle East in Europe. Right. It doesn't work out very well. But second, what they would do if they were here en masse is, yes, they would vote for parties that brought even more of them into Europe and more different other peoples as well, so as to weaken the white majority over and over and over again. And then once that was done, they would just start, well, I mean, I don't really need to say it explicitly, but once the democratic process was done, the demographic process would begin, in which they took us over by other means. And that would not be pretty.
But we'd be like the Copts. You know, the Copts in Egypt, the Kemetans were the original Egyptians. The people, I mean, now obviously Egypt's demography is mixed up by the fact that a lot of people did convert to Islam. But the Copts in Egypt were the majority at the time of the Arab conquest, right? And now, you know, look at their status in Egypt. They're second-class citizens at best, and there's like 3 million of them left, right? I mean, in a country of like 80 million, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it would be similar or worse for us Europeans. So,
this is where the real, the sort of rhetoric that we've edged around with that the left has become much more vocal on, of eliminating whiteness. And then they say, oh, no, we don't mean killing anybody. We just mean eliminating basically the UN definition of genocide, right? You know, but really what they do mean is, like, none of these movements say that they're going to put you up against a wall until they actually put you up against the wall and do a holodomor on you, right? But that's what they're rhetorically preparing for, and it means that all these other groups are absorbing that in the same schools, right? You know, as wouldn't this be a worthy goal to eliminate whiteness, right? So
yeah,
in the past, they would just conquer you and tax you, but now it's being set up for something far darker, unless we do what you said and take our own side, you know, and organize in that way.
Yeah, definitely. I think that just has to happen. There is just no reason why other people would fight for your corner, for your interests.
Oh yeah,
it's just not in human nature.
Well, especially
the only people who do that, ironically, are us.
Right. Well, particularly if they see you not taking your own side, then why would they? In a one sense, it could be another one of those pragmatic decisions. It's like a lot of East Asians could otherwise. I'm not saying they should be here, but they might otherwise see a kindred people in us for other reasons. But if we're not even taking our own side, then their pragmatic decision is, well, why would I ally with a group that, like, doesn't, you know, it doesn't stand up for itself, right? It doesn't stand up for itself. It's always taking the side of this, you know, this other group that we also dislike, you know, to go back to that, like, right?
And that's the other thing about the Palestinians. If they did migrate to Europe, I don't think they would be maybe some of them would be thankful and grateful to be living in Europe.
There's always a few, right?
You but know. I think a lot of them would be thinking, these people around me were the allies of the Jews, the Israelis, who robbed me of my homeland. These people helped them to do that.
Right.
So I just think it's insane. It's almost the definition of insanity.
All this is insane.
Allow them to move here.
It's deranged. Any of these groups, really, given the poisonous climate that's being created, so you have to it gets back to what we were talking about. Our current elites are, you know, there's that old saying from the 90s, never attribute to malice which can be explained by stupidity, except that our elites aren't, like,
they're not stupid.
They're not stupid.
That's a cope. They're not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing.
Right. And nor are they just misguided, right? They are, you know, these things that are being done are malevolent. They're not something that's done to people who you like, right? They're even very open about it themselves, right? Usually it's the underlings that say things like, we want to eliminate whiteness. It's not the more prominent figures. Like, you'll never get Bill Gates saying that, or much less a prime minister. But they put up with it because their own goals are not that different. That's why they're moving towards these things, right? It's like, another of the things that Morgoth said the other day is, you know, if it was just incompetence or just being misguided, then you would think sometimes they would make a decision that would actually benefit us, right? But they never do. They move towards all these things.
Yes. And literally everything that they do, every decision they make is bad for Britain, bad for Sweden, bad for Germany, whatever.
Right.
So, yeah, it's not incompetence. I do think that sometimes they make mistakes.
Oh, they're not perfect, no, yeah.
But, I mean, they're not... like for as we were saying earlier in a previous stream, letting Twitter fall to Elon Musk, I think, was a mistake. I don't think they would have let that happen had they thought about it in advance. I think that it was a mistake. I think the internet actually was kind of a mistake.
The internet was a mistake. That's why we sort of touched on that earlier. They thought that having this sort of internet 2.0 that, you know, from say 1998 to 2012, with where it was very freewheeling and Wikipedia even was more open to editing, and the old TV tropes, which was this idiosyncratic dudes thing, that was a mistake from their point of view, which is why ever since then they've cracked down and the moderation has become what it is, right, on all these things that used to be much more freewheeling, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think even Brexit, like David Cameron offering the referendum.
He didn't think that it was going to pass.
He didn't think. And I think in the same way, that's why the I think that's why they, you know, social media, they just thought, well, our ideas will win.
Right.
So we can do this. And that was a miscalculation. And David Cameron doing the referendum, it was a miscalculation. And so I don't think they're perfect.
No.
I think they do make mistakes.
They're not perfect, but you can tell by how they handled each of those, what their true goals were. So, like, Brexit happened, but they did everything in their power to neutralize it. And even then, under Boris Johnson, turn it on its head. So, now Britain won't take in as many migrants from Eastern Europe, but guess where you're going to get them from now?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I saw this, like a quote from a government minister or something saying, well, the British public have made it clear that they don't want more mass immigration from Europe. So that means that Britain can now become a global nation,
right,
and invite people from all over the world, because that's obviously what the British public want. It was something like that.
Not
those exact words, but something as awful as that.
And look how much migration has gone up under the Tories, basically ratcheting each year. And each time they will say, no, we're really going to do something to crack down on abuses of the system. But it's always these Rube Goldberg things that never actually...
Yeah.
Have any effect? Well, they know it's not, you know, they know it's going to be ineffectual. Otherwise, they would come up with a plan that was effective, right? I mean,
yeah, of course.
Instead of just we're going to send them to Rwanda, and the facility we built there can only house 200 people, right? And we know it's going to be blocked by the Supreme Court.
Roughly the same as one council house in Leicester.
Right, I know, right? It's just a joke.
But yeah,
you know, there's 700,000 people coming in, right? Something like that, something absurd like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's crazy. I think it was 1 million last year, and I can't remember. I don't want to be I don't want to be giving out bad information, but it was huge.
In America, we thought 1 million a year was high when Pat Buchanan was railing against it 20 and 30 years ago, right? And that's a country that's 5 times the population of Britain, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. Now a million a year is paltry to us here because we're taking in like three or whatever. If we even, we probably don't even know how many cross the border, right? I mean, so, yeah.
No, no. And that's another thing is the fudge with legal and illegal migration. Yeah. One way to reduce illegal migration is to make it legal.
Well, that's what the left's goal is, right? No person is illegal, right?
So, yeah. You couldn't make this up. Again, it's like something from a comedy.
Yeah.
Where you would, that's how you would deal with it. That's how you'd eliminate the problem. You would just stop calling it a problem. So, yeah, I think this gets back to what we were saying earlier, that if you've got the power, then you can basically just make things happen because you just redefine terms.
Right.
And no one's going to hold you to account for it. You're not going to be punished for it because you're doing what the power wants. So things will be made easy for you. And there is
incompetence in all of our governing elites, and indeed the competency crisis among in that circle itself has gotten very severe. But to emphasize your point, we saw how fast and how effective all of our countries could be just 3 years ago during the pandemic, right? When they all decided on a dime to enforce something that they had said was not the way to go. And lock everything down, right? How quickly they could get the signage out, mobilize everything, make it happen, make people stop going places, implement new rules, implement a whole new social structure almost overnight, right? And then everybody complied. And then when they turned it off, they turned it off, right? So yeah. If they want to really stop migration, it's not a technological problem. It's not an institutional problem. They don't really want to do it, right?
Yeah, it's just a problem of will. They just don't want to do it.
They want the opposite. They want the increased numbers, not the decreased numbers, and so that's what they get.
And you saw it also in the 2015 migrant crisis.
Right.
If they want to transport 2 fucking million people into Germany in 1 year, they can do it.
They can do it on a dime. Yeah.
They've got the logistical expertise and the resources and the funding and the training to do that, to do something, a huge logistical challenge like that. They know how to do it. And as you say with COVID, when they want to get something done, they can fucking do it. And another one would be Derek Chauvin. He was so thoroughly fucked over by the American state. It was incredible. They had I'm not familiar with the terms, but they had the state charges, the state court, and then the federal court. There was a federal charge against him as well. So if the state trial somehow found him not guilty, then the federal trial would be triggered.
That's how they can get around the, you know, we still have that on the books. We still have prohibitions against double jeopardy, but the loopholes, again, that came in during the civil rights era are used for that, right? So, again, that also means that, you know, we live in societies and y'all imported it from, you know, the global American empire into your own societies of this idea of protected classes, which means that then there are unprotected classes, right? So there are some cases that can be moved up to a higher court and then even have multiple trials over the same underlying offense if those in power really want it, right? So a man who's innocent by the declarations of the coroner who invested the death of that man, right, and found out that it wasn't any kind of chokehold, it was a drug overdose.
Yeah, was it not double the fatal dose of fentanyl? Right.
And so this person gets sent to prison and then treated the way he was treated in prison to make it's an example of it, right?
It's just abominable.
Yeah.
But my point with talking about those different trials that were waiting to happen. My point that it's like a backup plan, and I think they had a third backup plan as well, but I can't remember what it was now. But my point is that the system, when it wanted to fuck him up, it knew exactly how to do it,
right?
And the whole thing was implemented. And so this idea that the system just can't do things, that it's so unwieldy and incompetent and whatever, is just utter rubbish.
When they want something done, they can do it. There is a decline in competence, and we can see it in the very people who are ministers in your government or secretaries in our government. and not just all of them are minorities. Like Anthony Blinken is a joke as a Secretary of State. But on the other hand, you're right that in the background, in various the staffing of the permanent departments, there's still enough competent people, despite the hiring of many multitudes of diversity hires. There's still enough competent people that when they really want to get something done, they can get it done in a flash.
I mean, it doesn't take a huge amount of intelligence or whatever to do this, like as in brain power to do this kind of thing. And therefore, that's why the competency crisis doesn't actually affect this. You just need to be crafty enough to use the tools at your disposal.
And brutal enough to enforce it. That's why, there's a lot of countries that stumble through it despite having systems that, from the point of view of governance, are far less professionalized than ours are even today, but can still manage to enforce a Stasi, right? Can still manage to enforce a police state on people very effectively, and maintain power. And many of these places, to get back to something you said earlier about elections, many of those places have pro forma elections. And most authoritarian states have elections. It's just that they don't mean anything, right? But they're still able to maintain their rule. They don't let dissident groups throw them over. Even Erdogan, he maintained his power in Turkey for, 20 years now? Something like that?
Yeah, I think it is something like that. Yeah, exactly. So I think this is all a big... And again, you hear people, and it's often conservatives who'll say this, that, it's just incompetent, that the system, they just don't know what they're doing, and, can you believe I've been that stupid? And it really is such a cope. It's remarkable that they can still believe that now. But I think it is a cope. Maybe they suspect at some level it's not incompetence. But the alternative explanation is just too scary.
Yeah. Well, plus it's what's told by their channels, right? What's that, BRTV in your country or Fox News in America, the putatively conservative channels will all come out with, look at how the current administration bungled this, that, or the other when the left party is in power. And it's just bungling. But that's like... that's part of the containment, but then many people will believe that because they don't want to believe the alternative, which is they're just not on our side. They have it out for us, right? That's why even my mother, who I've talked to about this a lot of times and pointed out that, even if you think Obama was done, the people behind him are not stupid. The reason they do these things that you think are stupid is because their goals are not your goals. Their goals are very different. Their goals are things that that we think are perverse because of how they affect us, but it's because their goals are antithetical to us.
Right? I think also it's so outlandish that the ordinary person struggles to believe it because it sounds crazy. And you'll know this, I think you'll have had this experience, when you say to a normie, basically the government wants us extinct, that sounds very far-fetched. Right. To your average normie
or even if you talk about this or that aspect of things, they'll say, that sounds like a conspiracy theory, a phrase invented by the CIA to do precisely so people can dismiss things. But it's a coordinated organization. What do? They plan and they implement plans. What is that?
And the CIA and the FBI have been doing this for decades. I mean, it's not like it just started last year. They know exactly, they're very, very well versed in this, in doing this kind of thing. So, and then the media, of course, their whole thing for forever really has been to implant narratives and ideas into the public's minds.
That's because
I remember hearing someone, it was a soap opera, and it was this ridiculous storyline they had where it was meant to discourage the viewer from believing in conspiracies. Right. And they had this one character saying to another one, so do you believe there's some big conspiracy with the powerful planning things? And I thought, I watched that and I thought, who the fuck could believe anything else? How could you possibly believe that the powerful don't conspire to get their way? What the fuck do you think the powerful do? Of course they do that. I mean, why wouldn't you? If you were the powerful, why wouldn't you be planning and shaping things in order to get your way. It's like you'd be doing it wrong. If you weren't doing that, you'd be doing it wrong.
What is it that Tony Blair does to this day, right? He goes to these various conferences and he's got the Tony Blair Institute. And what do? They come up with plans and then they present them to governments to implement, right? Or to mention what you just said about the intelligence agencies and news media, there's a book, Cultural Cold War, you know, which was titled in the United States, I think, Who Paid the Piper? The CIA and, you know, social movements or something like that. And all these sort of ties between intelligence agencies and publications and even artists go right back to the early Cold War, if not before. The author of that book only really covers the post-war era. But right after basically the foundation of the CIA, which had its mandate to only operate outside of America, right? They weren't supposed to conduct operations in America. And the reason I bring that up is, like, right from the beginning, James Burnham, who was with the, you know, working in the CIA, he was violating that right and left, right? You know, the so-called rule of law. And I'm not saying that, oh, the CIA should be imposed on other countries. I'm just saying that all this stuff that you just mentioned, it's not even that it's a closed secret now. It's out in the open, but people just don't want to credit it, right? And most people haven't heard of books like that because, to go back to your other thing, is like, where are you going to find that in the shelves of even a good university library, right? You're not going to find it, right?
Absolutely. And it's also it's far-fetched. So they think, it can't happen because it can't be real because it's far-fetched. And they believe in democracy. Yeah. So they think that the way things happen is that the public vote for them. And then a party either implements those ideas or it's incompetent and it fails to.
It's grassroots, right?
Yeah. So they believe, as I was saying at the start of this, that we believe that we could affect change from the grassroots without being crushed by the establishment. But no, what happens is that the establishment make things happen and the public are enjoined to vote for those things, or that fails and their wishes are simply ignored anyway.
Right.
That's the way things happen.
Or and they let it happen on the surface, but then they undermine it.
An inconvenience. Right? Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Or they let it happen as with Brexit, but then they like take away the victory underneath, right? You know, with the bottom hand, right?
Exactly.
So then they can say, look, you got what you want, but look how badly it turned out. Well, that's because they manipulated all the rulings made after Brexit to make sure that it would turn out as things have, right?
So, yes. And one irritating thing is when you see leftists anti-Brexit, like Remainers on Twitter saying, it hasn't worked out well for you, has it? I hope you're pleased with yourself. I hope you're proud of what you did. It's been a complete failure. And it doesn't seem to occur to them. First of all, that isn't the fault of the Brexiteers. It's not the fault of the people who wanted Brexit. And second, maybe the system that we were opposing by voting for Brexit and which you support as a Remainer, maybe that system has made sure that Brexit didn't work. But that's too much thought for them.
Right. Well, you know, and then these same people won't wonder how a person who was rejected by the Conservative Party nonetheless ended up in the campaign for leadership after Boris left, somehow ended up as prime minister anyway. And I'm not saying Liz Truss was good. She was an incompetent boob, let's put it that way. But there was also some behind the scenes things around the shaking up of the pound, right? And then immediately having everything go back to normal as soon as they got the person they wanted in the prime minister's chair. And they can say, look, Boris was for Brexit. Look, and then he became prime minister and implemented. Well, Boris is a character that could deserve a whole show of itself just to go into, you know, what Boris is for, which is basically Boris, Alexander Johnson, and where his sincere loyalties lie. Let's just put it that way, you know. So,
I mean, yeah.
I think you would still be better under him than you are now, but that's not saying that he was on the side of the people who voted for the thing that he ostensibly was also for, right?
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I've said before, I think that Boris is a complicated guy to talk about. He's complicated to describe, but basically I think that he was good for us more by accident than anything else, which is that he didn't believe in the COVID stuff. And so I think if it had been a different prime minister, COVID would probably have been a worse experience, even worse in experience than it was in Britain. And it was bloody bad enough. But I think he held it back a bit.
Well, and I think that's probably, I think you're probably right on that. And that's one reason why they then thought it would be a good twist of the knife to get him out on things that were sort of tangentially related to his behavior during COVID and all that, and use that as an excuse to make him resign. Right. But they didn't like him for other reasons. Right. But partly for that, but you know, partly because Alexander Johnson is Alexander Johnson's guy. He's not necessarily their guy in the same way Sunak is.
Right? Yeah. I think he's too much of a loose cannon. He's too unpredictable. Whereas someone like Rishi Sunak, totally controllable.
Right.
Probably not an original thought in his head.
Yeah. Johnson would listen to the Tory electorate if he thought that that would help him win the next election, whereas Sunak will just do whatever the powers that be want, you know.
Exactly.
Hell or high water, right?
Exactly. And that's two different forms of individualism there.
Right. You
know, one of them is self-interested. like, I'm just out for myself. And the other is also self-interested, but via a power. Powerful entity rather than by the public. Interesting.
Well,
but then, of course, why would you expect Rishi Sunak to have any ethnic loyalty to the British people? Of course.
Well, I think what you just touched on there, too, is one way the current elites maintain their cohesion is in some of the things that come out later, like how we never found out who all was on Epstein's list, right? Like that. Sunak is going to be their man because he's only got his position because of them. He doesn't have an independent base of support like Johnson could build up, because whatever else one might say about Boris Johnson, he's charismatic with his flamboyancy, right?
Yes.
So he can become independently popular, whereas these other apparatchiks, they know that if they don't tone the line, someone else can just be put right in there in that same slot and the train will move on without them.
Definitely.
So they're never going to defect. And corruption can be used to keep people in line. Like, you know, corrupt prelates in my church, who it comes out later what they were all up to. Well, then you know why they were there, because they were then kept in line to support all these things that are actually against Christian teaching. You know, I don't want to delve too much into that, but the nakedly corrupt Clintons, but they were always moved up. Why? Because they were never going to really go against the thing that they're also a part of, and maybe even a power center in, because then the rest of the dogs could tear them apart, right?
Exactly, exactly. I think in the case of Rishi Sunak, he's a dull non-entity, and a sort of identikit politician. As you say, there are many like him, many to replace him. And such a man is very easily controlled, because he's useless. On his own, he's useless. And it's the same, actually, with up in Scotland with Hamza Yousaf.
Right.
He, same thing. He didn't win an election. He was put in there when Nicola Sturgeon resigned. I don't think he would win an election.
No, probably not.
So I don't think that Rishi Sunak would win one either.
Right. And well, it might be one reason why he was put in as a Scottish PM, because guess which party kind of needs those Scottish seats in order to win a majority. Now, they're going to win a blowout majority probably anyway, but Labour always benefited from having seats up there in the British Parliament.
Indeed, indeed. And who's in charge of Scottish Labour, though?
Right.
A fellow Muslim.
Right. It's all gotten so weird.
It's so weird. I mean, how would you think this? You know, Scotland, Ireland, these aren't countries known for their ethnic, for their brownness.
No.
So how did it possibly happen? Well, because we know, I'm not, it's a rhetorical question, but the point is that, yeah, these men are entirely reliant on their, on the power structure for their power, for their position.
Well, that so does go, yeah. One thing that I'd like to touch on, because those places you just mentioned, Ireland in particular, but also Scotland, is Ireland became independent of Great Britain on the backs of a genuine nationalist movement that was Ireland for the Irish, right? And I think the early Scottish National Party was more like that too. But yes. What we've seen is a lot of these parties becoming, they're no longer nationalist for the Scottish or for the Irish. They're just against, say, the English or the British. And I think that gets to one thing I wanted to touch on in a discussion of old Canada versus new Canada, because I've been an admirer of old Canada, and this is the Canada of before the first Trudeau, where they're, you know, they're flying an ensign that's closer to a version of the British flag, and that Canada actually had more Canadian characteristics, I want to say. But then Pierre Trudeau came along, and he invented a different type of Canadian nationalism. We're no longer going to see ourselves as part of the British Empire, though we're still in the Commonwealth. And we want to distinguish ourselves from America, so we're going to be very boldly a unique Canadian vision for what it means to be Canadian that's not like those Yanks and not like those Brits. And what was it? Well, it was basically the Harvard-Georgetown mindset, right? Or in Ireland, that's what's basically happened to the Irish nationalism, is it's been absorbed into this sort of, it's now a false nationalist movement, sort of like the Catalonian nationalism, that it sticks it to the eye of, say, the Spanish government in the case of Spain, or the London Parliament in the case of Scotland. But it no longer argues for its own people. It's basically for the same generic policies that the entire transnational globalist movement is for, right? It's different.
It's even for the same policies that the British government.
Right.
Is for.
It's not really different in any substantive way, right?
Yeah, it's just a It's masquerading as a pro-ethnic party. Really, what it is anti-English, but not even that, because even that is fake. What it actually is a tool with which to break up a powerful country into multiple smaller, less powerful countries, so that which in turn will be more dependent on the globalist apparatus.
More easily manageable chunks of, you know, the administrative zone Scotland, or what was it that Orwell rechristened the British Isles in 1984, Air Base One, you know what I mean? We're just going to be...
Airstrip One, yeah.
This hub of Google's server farm in Ireland, for example, or wherever.
Yeah. Server Farm One.
But otherwise, we're going to adopt the exact same policies and vision on everything as everybody else does. So there's no, not the first to mention this, but it's the irony of diversity is it's really homogenizing everything down to a very base and ignoble level, though, right? You actually lose a lot of unique, distinct things that had made a people by blending it all into this thing, all in the name of a diversity that doesn't have any substantive, especially at the top, where you have to believe, as you said earlier in the show, here is your philosophical perspective, and it's all basically one set of people reading from in the same direction. Everybody's supposed to, and if you don't hold that, then you're out. Your persona non grata. You will not have any social status or even voice in the future.
Oh yeah, that's clearly what is desired here by the elites. To end on a more upbeat note, I saw in your conversation notes that you talked about the evolution of the alt-right, and you talked about more productive groundwork being done now. Is that correct, or have I misunderstood?
No, I think that's correct, and it is something that I touched on in my sort of earlier ramblings on millennial itself as a microcosm of that, is all of the very sound building that has been done over the last 6 years or so, whenever it was I was last on in 2016. People have a deeper intellectual understanding. We've read all the books, right? Or whatever like trite phrase I want to use, and we've internalized a lot of knowledge and then shared it across in ways that are really promising, but hard to keep up with because there's so much of it. I think there's been a deepening and an expansion of the space, you know, the dissident right space, despite those setbacks that we talked about and the very severe challenges that we face. And to the point where some of those will out in the quote real world gatherings that were made in 2016 that came to nothing because they were sort of protest activism are instead replaced by not just doing things online, but the building up of much stronger networks of organizing on the ground, which is the only thing that's going to be the genesis of a counter elite in the future. Is not just, I mean, online is good, and that, we're doing this online, right? But people are building, across a wide range of fronts, I want to say, in a way that's very inspiring in a way. A lot of effort is going in and a lot of achievements have been made.
Yeah, and thank you for your words about millennial. I think it's, I wasn't thinking in those terms at the time that it was going to become an institution a tradition.
No.
Let's say a tradition, that's more more accurate.
Sure.
But I think it has become that, and I'm very proud of that, very glad.
You should be.
Thank you. And I hope it continues into the future. Next year will be the 10th, and I'm planning something. I don't know. I'm not yet sure what to do for that. It might be the standard thing, but even a particularly big bumper edition of it with maybe 100 streams. Which,
oh, my goodness. How do you manage all that, though?
I don't know. But either that or something very different, which would be a situation where people interview me.
It could be fun.
It would be fun. And just as a one-off. I certainly wouldn't want that to be the typical thing, but no. I think it would be an interesting an interesting novelty for the 10th anniversary, which is also the 10th anniversary of my channel.
Right.
So, which obviously no longer exists.
YouTube. It's a new forum, doesn't it, though? I mean, that's the thing, is like pruned, it grows again, right? I mean, so your channel was taken away and you rebuilt, right? So
yeah, and also I've spread to other platform, Telegram and Substack now. And Substack, I could talk about that for ages. That's been a huge new lease of life for me. Uh-huh. So I'm very glad to have done that. But my point is that, the Millennial Woes project, so to speak, lives on far beyond the original YouTube channel. But it did all start 10 years ago. So that's why I want to do something next year to celebrate that and to look back on the 10 years. But that aside, I do think you're right about the movement having matured. I think we've learned a lot about things to do and things, especially things not to do.
Right.
People are more aware, more savvy now than we were back then. I think it's kind of like, it's funny, you know, it's like when lovers look back at the start of the relationship and they think, well, we were just beginners. We didn't know anything. we didn't know about relationships. We didn't know about love and whatever. And I think it's kind of the same with this. It's like we really did not know what we were doing.
Well, all the struggles, but how it's still worth it, you know. So,
Yeah. It's been a very meaningful journey, very difficult for many of us. Compared to some, I've got off lightly. Yeah, there are. I mean, look at James Alex Fields, for God's sake.
No, I know. It's just that some people have been just destroyed. Even it's not too strong a word for what's happened to some people. So, but I don't think that doesn't mean we can minimize the sort of things that you were put through either, right? You know,
no.
Different challenges were faced by different people in there, but for the grace of God, go us. But it's been hard all around, right?
Exactly. I mean, my point is that lots of people have suffered in different ways.
Right.
But the result is, you know, at this stage, that we're a much more sensible movement than I think
sensible
we were.
Center. steal somebody else's phrase, right?
Possibly. I do think sensible, if not centrist, then we're definitely more sensible than we used to be.
Well, that's sort of a tongue-in-cheek phrase, too, but that's like it's he uses it to highlight a point of what the how they rhetorically place themselves in a position that they don't really belong in, right?
Yeah.
One of the things we can do, too, to reach out to what you said earlier, the normal people, is to position ourselves as the sensible center.
Yeah, and, he talked about it on last year's Millennial, and I agree with them. I think I don't think that we should revel in the idea of being radical or extreme or fringe. Right. I've had more than enough of fringe types. They're a fucking liability.
Yeah, it attracts the wrong type of person, and it turns off the kind of people that otherwise might get us a listen, right?
Yeah.
Because if we pose as what our enemies portray us as, then, and this was one of the mistakes too that was done by some people in the 2016-2017 era, even in 2015, is if you don the garb that the enemy wants to put on you, you're not helping yourself. You're not doing what blacks do by taking the word N back, because they have the force of, they have the wind behind their back, right?
Exactly.
You instead pigeon yourself in a way that lets the people who otherwise might listen to what you have to say what Hillary said about them is right. Look at what they're doing. You know,
exactly.
Even though some of those things were exaggerated and didn't even take place the way it was portrayed, it was enough, right?
Yeah, and you're doing your enemy's work for them.
Right, and you don't want to do that.
A good thing to live by here is never do your enemy's work for you. If your enemy wants something, don't hand it to them on a platter. Right. And as I said in a previous stream, if your enemy desperately doesn't want you to have something, that's a sign that you should want it.
Right.
And vice versa. So I think these are lessons that we've learned. I do agree that we're more prepared in that way. I also think we're more aware of the transience of social media platforms than I certainly am. I think everyone is.
Yeah.
That naivety that we had about that back then has very much been...
We took a lot for granted. We really did.
And that's definitely gone. I think it's... I also think that we've just created an ongoing record of a period in time which was unique and is unique and gets more bizarre and surprising by the year. So I think if nothing else, at least we've done that. You know, we've created a document of what it was like to live in this era.
Yeah.
Because God knows the mainstream record of it won't be accurate at all.
That'll be important going forward. And I think that is one of the things that I would encourage you to do for millennial 10th anniversary is perhaps when you are being interviewed, have some of the clips of your old stuff that we talked about before. And if you're too self-conscious of being too congratulatory by putting it out there for yourself, having others comment on some of the favorite things that they remember of both past millennials and some of your older content, like I mentioned the one, and I could mention several others, but we don't want to go too long. that is a thing for next year, maybe, you know, is a retrospective, but not just to look back, but to look forward based on what we've already done, like you just
definitely
said.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't want it to be like, oh, just how prescient you were, Colin.
No.
Incredible. In some ways, I definitely wasn't prescient, and it would be interesting to find those, to see the thinking of that time and realize the flaws in it and realize what we've learned, because there will be things we've learned without quite being conscious of it.
Right.
So it would be interesting to look back for that reason. I mean, one way it could be done is to have each stream, each interview could be based around a particular video or a particular Substack essay or whatever, and use that as the basis. That could be interesting. But again, this is... I'll be thinking about this throughout next year, and we'll come up with something. Awesome. for this time, I'm just concentrating on this millennial, and it's been such a fascinating year. So there's so much to talk about just from this year, you know.
Right. No, that makes sense. And one thing before we go to, I want to compliment you on those introductory videos that you have. It's very British and very cozy. The train, you know.
So, oh yes, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of work, and it's turned out well.
It's cool.
So thank you. It always means a lot when people notice this stuff, because it is much more time consuming than it might appear to create these things. So when people appreciate it, that means a lot.
Well, I know you have an artistic aesthetic sensibility because of, you know, maybe the background that people are less aware of your, you know, you've always been an artist, and your artistry shows in what you do. So including that video.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I mean, I was very proud of the trailer this year. Uh-huh. And so yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for agreeing to appear again.
Oh, and thanks for inviting me back on. And I enjoyed doing it. I rarely, if ever, do these things. Mostly I'm a gadfly anymore in people's comments. I was grateful for the opportunity. So thank you. Thank you so much for having me back on. And then for catching up, we got to catch up in a lot of ways because we haven't really been this much in contact with each other since around that era and a little bit after.
Indeed. I mean, part of that is because I got banned from Twitter.
Yeah, I know.
We kind of lost touch. But yeah. I'm glad that we've regained contact.
Excellent.
So, yeah. All right. Well, I'll be back tomorrow night with, hold on a second. I'll get the schedule up and I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow night. It's John Waters, then Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, then Keith Woods, and then George Bagby. So that should be another interesting night. All right. And so
let me just say, too, since Millennial may be a little too reticent to say it himself, he has an excellent lineup this year, and y'all should tune in.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Well, everyone, I will see you all tomorrow night. Hope you've enjoyed this, the first night of Millennial 2023. I think it's gone well. And in the meantime, Porphyrogenitus, thank you for appearing on Millennial again.
Thank you. Thank you again. Thank you so much for being a gracious host.
Excellent. You're welcome. All right, everyone, see you later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Find the info at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.